This show is sponsored by Midi Health. There are great things that come with age: wisdom, experience, and knowledge, just to name a few. But if you're a woman over 40, it can also bring some less desirable things like hot flashes, insomnia, brain fog, moodiness, and weight gain, all symptoms of menopause and perimenopause. Yes, hormonal transition is a fact of life, but that doesn't mean you have to accept its symptoms as just another part of aging. Midi clinicians are menopause experts, equipped to support you with safe, effective, FDA-approved medications, as well as supplements, lifestyle coaching, and preventative health guidance. You'll come out of the experience feeling heard and with a plan to start feeling better. Midi offers accessible care. All their services are covered by insurance, and they're conveniently accessible through telehealth visits and 24/7 messaging. You deserve to feel great. Book your virtual visit today at joinmidi.com. That's joinmidi.com.
You're listening to KCBS In-Depth.
Really, in order to find quality care, you often have to be on a wait list that's months long.
The people, places, and issues the Bay Area is talking about.
The aggressive advocates who were looking to overrule Roe for so long, they really had no idea of the consequences they might be opening up.
In this case, there very well may be charges that are appropriate. For example, trying to obstruct an official proceeding of Congress, right? That is unlawful.
This is KCBS In-Depth.
Research shows that climate change isn't just something that's negatively affecting the planet. It's having a deep impact on our mental health as well. Every new wildfire, every flash flood, every heat wave brings on another level of eco-anxiety in many people. A survey conducted by UNDP, Oxford University, and Geopoll found that 56% of respondents think at least once a week about the problems caused by the climate situation. And these feelings can be even stronger in younger people. Welcome to KCBS In-Depth, broadcasting throughout the Bay Area and streaming on the Odyssey app. I'm Mary Hughes. It can feel overwhelming to see all that our environment is going through and wonder what can be done, or to even have experienced an extreme weather event firsthand, to carry that trauma and not know how to heal from it. It's a big conversation, and so we're turning to Jennifer Silverstein, a licensed clinical social worker in Sonoma County, who is endeavoring to build resilient communities, especially for the youngest and most vulnerable, so that they can face the unfolding ecological crises. Thank you so much for being a part of this conversation on KCBS's In Depth.
Oh, you're welcome. I'm glad to be here.
So I know in my own life and in the lives of those that I'm close to, we think about climate change and the environment and the, you know, things that are happening to the planet quite a bit. And for some people that I know, this can bring on a lot of feelings of anxiety, of worry, and it does create mental stress for them. When did this become something that you were aware of in the work that you do?
For me, as a human being, I think I've been aware of it for a very long time. As a therapist, I became very conscious of it following the Tubbs fire here in Sonoma County in 2017. And I should add that I am a early childhood specialist. So my work is has primarily been with young children and their parents and people entering parenthood. So what I saw following the Tubbs fire was, I traditionally work with a lot of children who've experienced trauma. And up until then, to work with very young children who've already had significant trauma in their life to the point where they're brought to therapy, I was really working with kids who were in foster care or in the had been adopted out of foster care. Those were my primary clientele. And following Tubbs, I started getting a lot of phone calls from children who otherwise had intact families, where their lives had been going as we would hope for them. And then the fire was such a source of trauma and anxiety that they were being brought into treatment. And my practice quickly filled up and I had a wait list. And when I looked around to my colleagues to see if I could refer, everybody was full and with a wait list. And that's when it really hit home for me how significant these impacts could be.
Well, and that was something I was curious about, was as far as like you and your colleagues and you know, you saying that, you know, wait lists filling up, so many families, young people needing professional people to kind of help them parse through what they were feeling and experiencing and going through. Is this something that you or others thought, oh, there's going to be a time where we're going to have to look at the trauma of extreme weather and climate on the mental health of the people we serve?
Yes, that for me, that really that moment in 2017 was the beginning of a new journey in my career, where I started intentionally looking more and more at how climate was impacting mental health and getting a sense of what can I try to do about this as an individual, you know, who's working with other individuals as a clinician. And it led me over time to the Climate Strategy Alliance of North America, which is a professional association of climate aware therapists and allied providers, so that I no longer felt alone in trying to figure that out. But I will also say I joined that organization in 2019, and it was so small that I almost nothing was really happening there yet. And in the ensuing years, it has blossomed so much because the need and the awareness of that need is growing exponentially. And so we're growing to try and meet it.
Well, and I think you hit on it right there. It underscores this need that has grown over time. How have you seen that connection between worries about the environment, worries about the state of the planet, worries about, you know, experiencing very specific moments of that fear, especially here in California with wildfires and what that can do and leave behind, and how it plays out in someone's mental health, especially younger people and those who are part of their family, who, you know, who are kind of being inundated by it while also perhaps going through it as well.
Right. So, you know, for me in my clinical experience, because I mostly work with very young children, what I would see in my office was kind of limited to the impacts of these direct events, because my clientele was really too young to also have these existential worries. But since I've become involved in the Climate Psychology Alliance, and I've been doing a lot of trainings and workshops and conversations, you know, across populations, it is very evident that as children age into greater awareness, that there are many young people who are experiencing what we would kind of call those existential worries and fears, where maybe they've been impacted directly, maybe not, but they're very conscious of the long-term threats and what that can mean for their futures. And one of the best resources for information on that is a study that came out in The Lancet a couple of years ago. Carolyn Hickman is the main author, and they interviewed 10,000 young people from 10 different countries. So it's a very robust study. What Carolyn Hickman's study found is that 56% of young people, these were children between ages 16 and young adults up to 24, 56% of them felt that humanity is doomed. 59% felt betrayed by their governments and people in power. And 48% reported that they felt so much anxiety or depression or whatever feeling they were naming, that it was actually impacting their daily functioning and making it difficult for them to get through their days. Here in Sonoma County, you know, then we have folks who are both directly impacted by events and worrying existentially about their future. And so, you know, there's a lot of children, older children in high school and college students who are really dealing with that double whammy. And, you know, when I go around and I speak to teachers and other providers, I hear a lot of that.
Those are huge numbers, really. Yeah. I mean, genuinely, when you think about that, how do you help people process this? And I, and you know, obviously, I think, as you said, you know, in the clinical work you've done with very young children, you know, there's not that level of existential thought about it, but they're still experiencing the trauma. But, you know, obviously you're dealing with parents and their, you know, fears are probably coming out as well. You know, how have you learned through your work and helping others to navigate these types of feelings?
Yes, I could speak to what I do personally, but also because I am in conversation with so many people in the climate mental health world, I will say that it is a emerging field where we do not yet have, you know, an evidence base of best practices. So we're really working with our own experiences, learning from each other and, you know, learning from what research is out there. And I can speak kind of to a consensus of what I see in the field is that, first of all, helping people build what we call a window of tolerance, which is language that comes from Daniel Siegel. Essentially, that idea is that when we are stressed, when our stress response system kind of kicks on because of a trauma or a fear or distressing event, it can either go into like hyper arousal, which is that fight flight and, you know, big emotions like anger and terror, or it can go into hypo arousal, which is that freeze state, where we shut down and we withdraw. And, you know, we see people doing that around climate all the time because it's so big and overwhelming that, it is a natural psychological defense to, distract ourselves, you know, and go back to scrolling on the screen or, you know, buy something that makes us feel good or eat something that makes us feel good rather than really sit with the information and the feelings it brings up for us. So really common, normal, actually biological stress responses to either be in that hyper aroused state or that hypo withdrawn state. And in either of those states, we can't really take effective action. We can't really process information well, and we're not going to be very good at what we really need to be doing right now, I think, to work on this crisis, which is joining together and working in community and collaborating with each other and finding our collective power. All of that is really hard to do in those stress response states. So the window of tolerance is... describes our capacity to have big emotions, have responses to distressing events, and still calm our bodies and our minds enough that we can use our thinking brains, kind of bring forward the best of our human abilities, still be able to communicate effectively and access problem solving and executive functioning. So we want to build our capacity. We want to expand our window of tolerance so that as we have more distressing things coming our way, we are able to meet that with higher coping capacity. So a lot of the work of climate mental health, whether it is in a therapist's office or, you know, in a more community-oriented setting, is work to build that window of tolerance. So finding activities that regulate us, people that we can talk to that regulate us. So, you know, the example I always give personally is the more time I spend walking in the redwoods, the better I feel. My cat helps me feel better. You know, my friends who I can talk to about this stuff help me feel better. All of those things expand my window of tolerance. And so that's kind of one of the big first things. It's like, let's be real about these feelings. So the other thing is that a lot of times people either feel isolated in their climate distress, like they haven't found people to talk to, or it's not validated by the people around them. So just, you know, being a listening ear and validating and normalizing those feelings is huge. And giving people a chance to process them, then building that window of tolerance through regulatory activities. And the aim is to get people to a place where we're able to land in an action that feels aligned with our values and our purpose. So it's like finding like meaning focused coping, like finding purpose in what we can put forward to navigate these challenges. And often the best actions are those collective ones, because it's so disempowering as a single individual to feel like, you know, what can I possibly do against this existential threat? And when we find the right collective to work in, whatever that might mean, you know, whether it's an activist organization or a garden club or, you know, there's so many ways that we can be taking action, but it's like we have to move through that process first so that we're not just using our actions to mask our feelings. We're actually like experiencing, integrating, and then choosing from that integrated place.
In Depth will return after a moment.
This show is sponsored by Midi Health. There are great things that come with age: wisdom, experience, and knowledge, just to name a few. But if you're a woman over 40, it can also bring some less desirable things like hot flashes, insomnia, brain fog, moodiness, and weight gain, all symptoms of menopause and perimenopause. Yes, hormonal transition is a fact of life, but that doesn't mean you have to accept its symptoms as just another part of aging. Midi clinicians are menopause experts, equipped to support you with safe, effective, FDA-approved medications, as well as supplements, lifestyle coaching, and preventative health guidance. You'll come out of the experience feeling heard and with a plan to start feeling better. Midi offers accessible care. All their services are covered by insurance, and they're conveniently accessible through telehealth visits and 24/7 messaging. You deserve to feel great. Book your virtual visit today at joinmidi.com. That's join, MIDI.com.
There was two things there that you said that I really honed in on. And the first one was when you were speaking about, you know, things that you can do, you know, personally that you do to kind of ground yourself. And you mentioned, you know, taking a walk and enjoying the redwoods. And I thought, you know, it's almost funny that, you know, we can turn to nature when it is nature that we are, of course, worried about or maybe have experienced some trauma with. But it does seem to work.
I think it works in a fundamental way where if you look back over the history of the evolution of humanity, I think there's a genetic priming to find comfort in the natural world of our home bioregion, that the sights and the sounds and the rhythms of our the world around us, the natural world around us, just inherently can calm and soothe us. And I say that with a bunch of caveats, which I can get into in a minute, but I do think there's something kind of fundamentally there. And I think, although this is not a universal truth by any means, but I think that there's a fair number of people who part of the reason that we feel this distress is because we are conscious of this connection and this love of place in the more than human world. And so we can be really resourced by that connection. And I know for me, when I'm out in redwood trees, it's a spiritual resourcing. They are wise old beings that, you know, are rooted and strong, and I lean into that and I feel comforted. So there's that. And then the caveats, I will say, first of all, there is a lot of information out there these days about the concept of solastasia, which is that feeling when it's like nostalgia for a home that we're still in because the home has changed irreversibly. And I experience that all the time when I walk in the hills in Sonoma County, because even driving by the hills in Sonoma County, I remember what they looked like before they were burned, and they don't look like that anymore. And so, and likewise with drought, you know, when I say walking in the redwood trees soothes me, it has to be the right place and the right time of year, because when it's the height of summer and it's land that is too dry and I notice that the redwoods are reacting to the drought, it's a lot harder for me to be soothed. So there's that caveat. And then the other one is, I recognize that I'm really speaking from a place of privilege and from my own, just sociocultural economic standing when I say that I personally find nature as a resource. I know that is not true of everybody, and I know that there are a lot of communities where there just is no access to that beautiful, more than human environment. And people might not find that as a source of comfort or connection, in part because they've never been given the opportunity, in part because of historical trauma related to, forest and woods and things that used to happen to folks' ancestors in those places. So this is complicated. It's not a one size fits all by any means.
Well, exactly. There are multitudes of levels to a conversation like this, and I appreciate you bringing those aspects up. And it does make me think about another point there that you mentioned about, what it means to turn to community to find people, like-minded people, or just people who are doing something where you can feel that there's a positive impact being made on something that can feel very overwhelming. And I think that's something we do for a lot of things, not just how we're being affected, of course, by climate change and what that might do to our mental, well-being. We can do this with a lot of stuff, but it does mean someone being willing to hear you or to take seriously the concerns and the fears and the traumas that you're dealing with. And, is that something that has taken a while to take hold that someone, people taking it seriously that climate change is having an effect on mental health?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I feel like I'm in a little bit of a bubble because here in Sonoma County, we have been dealing with this in a very personal way for long enough that I find mostly I end up talking to people who are developing aware, if not highly aware of this, developing awareness of it, interested in learning more, wanting to figure out what to do about it. I don't encounter around here a lot of people who are, in such denial that they're doubting that climate change is even real or that it could impact us in that way. So, from within my bubble, I will say that I'm in a place where people are conscious of that, but that doesn't necessarily mean that we are fully capable of having the kind of healing and supportive community that I hope to see and that I would wish for, because that is again much more complicated. We live in a very isolating society, and if anything, have gone much the other direction, and continue to be going much the other direction, where people are feeling more and more isolated. And so for me personally, that's been the shift in my work, is that I don't actually work one-on-one with people anymore. I found that it felt inefficient, that ever since that wait list started post Tubbs fire, I was like, how are we ever going to have enough clinicians, enough therapists to actually meet the growing need? And so I started rethinking, what can I provide as a mental health? What can I offer? How can I use my skill set as a mental health provider to offer a more to scale up, essentially, the support that we need to see for each other? And so I've been really involved on a personal journey, and then also in exploring other people's work on community resilience and what we can do to build community where people feel heard, where people feel able to connect, where and so a lot of that dovetails with trauma responsive community, developing trauma responsive agencies and settings. My goal is that every place where a child goes, that there will be adults around who hold that trauma-responsive knowledge and that ability to hear and validate and suggest regulating activities and so on. And so whether that's schools or at home with family or community activities. And then I'm also very, very interested in a model called the Friendship Bench. It was developed in Zimbabwe. And the idea with the Friendship Bench was that there was such limited access to professional mental health care in Zimbabwe. People just were not able to take the 4 or 5 hour trip. They didn't have the money for the bus to, you know, get to a professional mental health provider. So they developed this program where they trained, it started with grandmothers, to be able to just sit on a bench in their community and be a listening ear and be able to hold space for whatever community members' concerns and distress was. And the program has flourished. This idea of that the capacity to hold space for people's emotions and help us find ways to move through these really distressing situations, that we can't hold that only amongst mental health professionals, that part of our work is in training people who don't have that professional background to within the right to be able to do the right amount of that work. And then obviously there has to be supervision of that. And there has to be a way to refer people who, you know, are, for example, at risk of suicide and really need more, you know, emergent and professional care, but helping programs where we can train lay people to kind of catch the majority of folks who won't rise to that level of concern, but can still be providing support for the concerns they have.
You know, obviously, there are a lot of things that we can do as individuals and as groups to feel like we are making a positive impact on the world around us and on the environment and what's going on. What's your advice for young people, for families of children who are going to, you know, only get older and grow up in this world? And really, it could be applicable to anyone who recognizes that climate change is a thing that's happening. It has these real world effects, but you want to be able to take care of yourself mentally while this is going on. What kind of advice would you give?
My first piece of advice is really, we can't do this all by ourselves. So finding that support, whether it's just that one friend or the school counselor, there are growing online resources. There's still a long way to go, but it's a rapidly developing field. The Climate Mental Health Network has wonderful resources for young people in particular. Climate cafes are a growing movement, which is essentially an opportunity to get together either in person or online, and with a facilitator, just talk about, this is the emotions that I'm feeling because of this. And just that opportunity to speak that in a group of people and feel heard is wonderfully supportive. So I think that is one piece is, you know, it really does help to find someone who is supportive. And then the other thing is, you know, really starting with, it's like creating an existential toolkit. It's like, what are the things that help me personally when I am feeling distressed? And of course, young people are going to need help figuring this out. You know, as an adult, it's easier to come up with a list of like, okay, when I'm at my most distressed, I turn on this particular podcast, or I listen to this particular music, or I go to church, or whatever that thing might be. And then we want to give ourselves as many doses of that as possible. But for young people, they're going to need help figuring that out. You know, what are the things that really make you feel like, what is your thing? Do you like crafting? Do you like writing poems? Like finding something that we can lean into as a resource, I think is super important, because that sense of having something that is kind of holding us through this can help a lot with coping with something so big.
You can find this episode and past episodes of In Depth online at kcbsradio.com. You can also hear in-depth episodes on the Odyssey app. Download the app on your smartphone and favorite KCBS radio. Thanks for listening. For KCBS and In-Depth, I'm Mary Hughes.
You've been listening to KCBS In-Depth. Get every episode by subscribing on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and other podcast platforms. Visit kcbsradio.com for more news and interviews. We are the Bay Area's news station, KCBS.